Hi everybody, we know it's been a while again since our last podcast, so I think I'm just going to say moving forward, expect them sporadically, but do expect something to appear. This has actually been triggered through a post on the Facebook page, and it is, I'm not trying to call out the individual who said it, because I do believe really strongly in educating people who have opinions that are sometimes not informed. But this individual, so please don't go and find this person and attack them. You can always share your experiences and, you know, explain why people are
stupid.
See, that's not helpful, is it? Why people are wrong. And I'm sorry, but in this situation, it is wrong. However, I will admit that I can kind of see the point of view, which I'll go into. So essentially, I shared a post recently, and it was how my child has been traumatized in school. You have to excuse me because I'm full of cold again. It's another reason I haven't recorded anything, because I've just been poorly yet again. And this person said that, you know, they think that social services should be involved if a child is removed from school, because surely there's a legal duty, obligation, or, you know, for all children to be in school in developed countries. And while this person is correct, all children are entitled to an education. Some parents, some families find themselves in a position like we did, where they, our son could not access school. He was distressed, his mental health was being affected, to the point that even the school said, at what point do we say this is affecting his mental health too much? He is distressed, he's, you know, constantly dysregulated, running out of the classroom. They couldn't teach him. I know some of this I've shared before, but just to clarify, we were told constantly how he was not capable of learning. Every report that came back always said he was below average. And, you know, again, I've told you before, I have no issue. If that was the reality, then, you know, you work with that. I don't ever place expectations on my children that are beyond what they are comfortable and capable with. But when you know your child is capable of something and you're told they can't do it, it's really frustrating. And when you say, well, actually, no, they can do A, B or C, and you're told, no, they can't, instead of a school accepting that maybe they can't see it because of the context they're in and that he's distressed in that environment, which actually this school did, but I know lots don't see it that way. You know, it's frustrating because you as a parent know that actually in a different context they can. But what happened with our son is he got to a point of such distress and trauma, because that's what it was, that he really internalised a lot of negativity on himself, developed a feeling that he was a bad person because he was running out of class, because he was making noises and distracting other children, and he wasn't being like the other children, and he couldn't articulate, he wasn't in that place, and even now I don't think he can fully articulate a lot of things. But he still felt that way, and more is coming out as he is getting a bit bigger. At the time, we knew he wasn't right because he was so withdrawn. He changed from a really happy little boy, you know, very snuggly, lovely little boy, to a very distant and withdrawn child who would stare into space. And again, you know, he does zone out sometimes, but it was different. His whole personality changed. And he had a lot of meltdowns, and like I said, very dysregulated. It was just an awful thing to experience. So for somebody to say, you know, social services should be involved if you're taking a child out of school, it really frustrates me, because really they should be more concerned about the child not coping in school. Like, you know, this is where the system needs to change. It is time. I mean, my husband had something good to say earlier about, I can't remember what you said. Can you remember what you said? The pressure.
I go off these little rants, so it's a bit difficult for me to actually remember.
Yeah, we were having a rant, and then I said, let's just record something.
It doesn't work that way. The minute you press the record button, it all disappears.
I agree. It is really tough. And our son's like that. I tried to have a talk with him the other day to put on the podcast, but as soon as I recorded, he saw the record button go on and froze, would say nothing. And yet it was really interesting, because we were talking about things before. It's very interesting, isn't it?
I'm going to attempt to do it, but basically we're trying to fit people into a system that doesn't inspire them, doesn't cater for their needs, and essentially destroys them of all individuality, and then we expect them to excel in that environment, and that isn't actually working. You're trying to get kids to learn stuff that's so abstract and doesn't apply to them, that they just think, what relevance does this have to my existence? They don't see the benefits because it's too hidden and it's too rote or, again, uninspiring. So you never get the engagement, especially with our type of children. So instead of playing to their interests and all the rest of it, you just get something dull and lifeless, and you're expected to really take that all in with your limited attention span. Well done. And then everyone's like, well, we can't do interest-led learning because, you know, it'd be too difficult. Well, as I'm trying to say, is for real change to happen so that everyone can access something and get something from the system requires change. And change isn't easy, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to change the system. We know the system is broken. So the actual act of trying to change the system and improve it will actually get a result, because necessity is the mother of invention. And if you are not trying to change anything and you're just accepting the status quo, then everything remains the same. The problems that we have will never disappear. I think that's basically what I was saying.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, you're right. And I think it was the point of necessity is the, you know, the mother of invention. And this is where people are very polarised in their opinions. So we even have family members who say, oh, SEND children shouldn't be in mainstream schools. And you're like, well, actually, some can thrive there with the right support. But agreed, there are some who don't belong there. But what they see as the viable alternative is, oh, open lots more special schools. But yeah, a lot of the specialist schools we are finding are failing children. I have so many people I know and so many people who've contacted me because, you know, obviously because of the platform I'm on and because of the things I share, they come to me for support, knowing that we've been through a lot of this stuff as well. And wow, it's been overwhelming how many people are actually struggling. They have fought to get their children into specialist schools, and then they're in specialist schools and they are failing. And the school doesn't really understand the child. And I've talked about this before. I am aware it sounds like I'm always coming down on specialist provision, and I'm not. I think it's just, I get so frustrated as a former mainstream teacher who worked in challenging schools with such high levels of SEND and all these other factors at play, that they always put down the mainstream schools. And I'm very sensitive over it because, and I know it's not all schools. I've worked in so many as a supply teacher to know that some really are not putting the effort in. And I'm not going to pretend every school is equal, because they're not. But the ones I worked in where we really did have those higher levels, you know, we were forced to do outside the box thinking. And did we meet every child's need? No. I can look back now and still feel absolutely dreadful over some of the children that now I have the knowledge I possess. You know, I could have helped more, but I did what I could with what I had at the time. And also, I was still in a system where, although our schools were a little bit better than some of the others, there were still things in place. There were still restrictions. There were still things we were not allowed to do. And I'll actually be honest, the time that I enjoyed teaching the most was when I was about to leave. I'd handed my notice in, and for my last few months, I did exactly what I wanted to do because I knew there was no repercussion for it. And actually, that was when my children made the most progress. And that's not an exaggeration. It's not a coincidence. I absolutely changed everything. I changed everything to the way that I wanted to teach. And, you know, some people scoffed because I did things like, well, I kind of applied reception kind of teaching, you know, which is play for learning, but it wasn't playing per se. But I think I've said this before. I was in year five and I thought, you know, I said to the children, give me all the things that you struggle with. So we had like fractions, decimals, you know, all the things that are quite tricky to get your head around. And I said, okay, leave it with me. Next week, we're going to address all of these things. And when they came in the following week, it wasn't a case of let's sit and look at a board and do fractions. Let's sit and look at a board and do decimals. I had found so many resources and a lot of tactile resources, which was one of the best things. And put them out on tables.
Makes it real, doesn't it?
It was real. And so, you know, for example, you have like a fraction wall. It's things where you can actually play with the fractions put them together. I'd seen something on Teachers TV years ago where they cut up cups and showed you the physical representation of a whole cup, a half a cup, a quarter of a cup. And it helps for them to visualise what those fractions are and how to add them. And, you know, so again, I didn't actually have a lesson plan in place as such. It was more, right, put all of these items out on different stations and let the children rotate and play with the stuff. And that was the first thing I did, just let them play. And then I walked around and I did a lot of targeted questioning, open questioning to extend the learning, you know. And I will admit, there are some teachers I've met myself who say, oh, I don't feel confident enough to do that. And so I kind of, you know, I understand there are limitations because you have to have such a great degree of subject knowledge. But what I did was whenever I had to deal with something that was, you know, something maybe I wasn't familiar with, because I'm a human being and I don't know everything, I would just, you know, put so much time in to learn that stuff. However, I'm going to be really honest, now I'm a parent, if I was teaching and I had my children, I don't think I'd be able to put in that same level. And so we need to be realistic about that. We need innovative, creative teachers, and we need to follow their lead. And I think the problem is a lot of the time schools don't really give you that freedom. And the reason schools don't is because they want to do well and they want to help their children, but they also get a lot of pressure from above and they've got the Ofsted issues. You know, and essentially I've said before, when I was being observed, things may have changed. It's been some years since I was in the classroom. But when I was observed, you know, things like the children all looking forward and not fidgeting, they were the kind of things that you got complimented on. So it's very weird what they measure as success, you know, whereas for me, like a bustling, engaged environment was, you know, more of a positive thing, to be honest with you. So,
yeah, because that shows they're at least excited by the subject.
Yeah. And this week, seriously, we spent a whole week and I was literally just putting resources out and we'd just go around the school and I'd try and make it as kind of interactive as possible. I might have put some games on the board. I might have had computer games going that dealt with the content. We'd go out on the playground and draw things. There's just so many things we did. One of the arguments I had from another member of staff was, yeah, but not every class can go and do that. But I'm not really sure why. I don't get it.
I just see a lot of excuse making. Again, it's a logistics thing. And I think once you get your head around it, you'll find that things are better. It just needs to change the mindset.
I can't remember where it is, but I want to say Norway, but I'm not actually sure. But it's somewhere that's not here.
Scandinavian.
Yeah, you know, but I'm sure I saw an advert for one of their schools once, and it was literally like a free-for-all, really, and it was amazing. You know, children got to go in and, you know, choose what kind of things they were interested in, and they learn through that way. I get that it is a completely different way of learning, but my argument is, at the moment, mainstream is really made for neurotypical children who can just sit there and look at a board and do it the way that things have always been done. But I still don't believe that those children, just because they're sitting there and they're engaging or they're, you know, able to pay attention, I still don't think that all of those children are getting the best experience. I don't think that that's the best way for all of those children to learn. You can have learning differences without being autistic and without having special educational needs. You know, for example, a study that was done years ago that I can't remember it to cite to you, but I'm sure it's somewhere. But when I was teaching, I read about how, I've shared this before, apologies for the repetition, but I shared that there was a study saying that boys actually engaged more with the lesson if it was outside the environment. So even if you gave them just a boring worksheet to do, you give them the worksheet in the classroom, no. Take it outside, all of a sudden in the environment, they complete it better. So imagine if you're actually, you know, just getting outside and doing more physical activities. Imagine how much more engaging that's going to be and what they're actually going to take away from it. And as an example, I've said this before also, we were learning about time, we had a clock on the board and the children just weren't, not even getting it. Some were getting it, some were not, but they were bored. And I'll be honest, I was bored thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's not going in and it is boring. I even found it boring to teach. So I said to the children, right, grab your coats, we're going into the playground. And I took all the chalks and we started then drawing clocks on the playground. We had a look at analogue, we had a look. And you know, at some point I think I had them acting as the hands. You know, there's so many things you can do. Off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly what I did. I'm very spontaneous in the moment. I know that, again, I have colleagues who've said, oh no, I struggle with that bit, you know, that's why I have my plan. But I also know so many teachers who are really like me. They're very spontaneous and creative. They can be in a lesson and go, this isn't working. You know, we've got enough subject knowledge to go, how else could we teach this? And what's frustrating with lesson planning and things like that is it's kind of too restrictive. You have to put so many hours of work into this nonsense just to provide for senior management. And it has all these things you have to like tick off. You have to have who you're working with, which children need differentiation, which, you know, there's quite a lot of that obviously in the classroom environment, especially where I worked. And there's just, you know, which is great to identify that you know who those children are. But I think you should get to a point in a year where you trust that the teacher actually knows their kids and you just let them go for it. And that isn't what happened. And I think I spent so much time planning that sometimes the resourcing suffered because you didn't have time to then go and make it exciting. You didn't have time to go and get the resources ready and make them or source them. And that used to be one of the hugest frustrations.
I'm seeing a lot of waste in that method.
Yeah, there is so much. It's such a waste of teachers' time. Now, I was told by a teacher who'd worked like years before me. She was quite an old lady, bless her, still teaching. She said, oh gosh, back when I started teaching, we used to have the curriculum and lesson plans. So you could literally go and, right, okay, so it's week three, you know, that's summer term. I'm going to go and pick up this planning. And, you know, while I'm not saying that it works across the board for every child, it doesn't. I agree. I think if you've got some kind of framework or idea in place that represents what they want you to teach in the curriculum, you should be able to take that plan and then adapt it.
Yeah.
So it gives you a scaffold that you can go, well, okay, so I need to teach this, and these are kind of roughly the ways I might choose to do it. You know, and I think that way you might find that teachers have a little less workload, and also they will be more likely to have the confidence to spontaneously change it because they haven't spent hours doing it.
Yes.
But the problem we have is senior managers, they say, right, we need your planning done. It has to meet all of these criteria. And then it has to be placed on your wall so that if anybody comes into your classroom, they can pick up your lesson plan. And if they are in that lesson at that time, it completely represents it. And I don't agree with that model.
Or have a system that's already baked with all that in mind so that the teacher doesn't actually have to do it, but it's actually a database full of stuff. They can pick it and then adapt it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it literally wouldn't take long at all. You could even have lesson plans where it says the type of learning style, so then you can mark it with the kids that do have the comparable learning style. And then the kids that don't, then you have to differentiate and deviate slightly.
But I still argue, right, that when I did some of the carousel teaching, that actually every child was engaged. Even I had children who, you know, I've told you about before, who wouldn't engage with lessons, who would find any excuse not to do it or to get out of the lesson. I now realise probably PDA. Didn't know at the time. Excuse me. But they were all engaged. And do you know why? Because that made it accessible. Because people, and also what was really amazing about it is I'm like a huge believer in utilising the children. Because the children often, when they've grasped something, they explain it better than you do in child speak. And I do remember a parent saying to me once, you always seem to use my child to teach other children. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. I actually am doing that. You know, because what it is with this particular child that was so good at grasping things and then passing it on. And so I used to kind of use them as my mini helper. You know, some people will absolutely despise that. But you're right, when a peer is discussing it or showing how they came, you know, so I did a lot of that kind of like peer interaction where they could go and have a look at something with no pressure of, right, you must meet this. Or it would be, I would circulate and I would ask questions to extend their thinking. And I'm such a believer in critical thinking, which we don't teach enough of in schools, you know. We taught the international primary curriculum. I don't know how that's faring in schools currently. I quite liked that. It was quite thematic. You know, everything has its faults, doesn't it? But again, what I liked about it was you had lesson ideas that you could then go, okay, right, you've told me to do it this way, about, say, a volcano. And whilst I love that, I'm going to adapt it by, we're going to make a volcano. You know, it gives, that could be a hook, that could be a way in to the lesson to make the children a bit more engaged with the subject matter. It's that kind of thing. So I quite liked the international primary curriculum. And the other reason is because it's meant to be done over the world. So, you know, people who do move from country to country, it means that they are all consistently kind of having similar learning. Obviously, you don't know what unit somebody's doing at a time, but it's... I liked the idea behind it, the fact that it gave you... I see it as really ideas. You know, I think what a lot of schools worry about is, oh, no, we can't give people a lesson plan because differentiation is so important. You're like, yes, it is. But, you know, trust your teachers. We're an intelligent bunch of people. Yeah, do you know what I mean? We're creative.
The lesson plan is there, and then you just differentiate instead of having to do the lesson plan and differentiation.
Yeah. And then something you said when I was teaching was, then if you have done that, if you've gone, right, okay, here's my plan, but I'm creating it and adapting it, then when that plan goes back in, why don't you put in the adaptations you made? Yeah. Why don't you put the resources you made into a box that's labelled with the same topic name, and then it's accessible to other people?
Absolutely.
Like teachers.
Best practice.
Exactly.
Because this is the thing, the amount of waste I saw just witnessing your job was ridiculous. The amount of materials destroyed. You know, even the display, we can to that point. And I'm thinking, that's a really great display. Why don't you, like, I don't know, laminate aspects of it so that you can then stick it up next time or something.
Or, again, if you've got a particular topic you're doing, put it into a box labelled with that and then somebody else can use it.
Yeah.
But what the problem is in schools, they don't like this kind of thing. They like, you know, all to be unique and different. Like, you're not allowed to reuse things. And
it's wasteful.
I don't really get it, to be honest with you.
It's waste of resources, money, time. Because, again, it takes time to get to do all this.
I physically could not do that job now to the same level I did it before. Now I have children.
It's stupid.
Whereas if some form of planning was in place, you would be able to.
Well, this is the thing, because you shouldn't have to take it all home with you. I mean, I understand marking work. But then again, you could argue, I don't know, if you stay an hour after the kids have disappeared, mark your work and then go home and enjoy an evening because you're not planning.
You should be allowed to have that balance as a teacher, but they don't allow it. And I know so many teachers.
Well, that's a cultural problem. That is a cultural problem. And if they don't address the work-life balance, especially when they've eroded all the other things that historically were attractive about the job, then you'd have a better retention rate. You wouldn't have people quitting so quickly.
Yeah. It's a tough job. And so kind of going back to what our original point was, I think what I'm trying to make a point of is, you know, mainstream teachers get an awful lot of flack. And I'm not going to say that everybody's amazing because they're not all equal yet again.
No.
But I think what people aren't realising is the majority of SEND students are in mainstream schools and you don't get anything extra for that. We have things like the graduated response, which I've discussed before. And that is a system where you have children at different levels. You have universal, which is basically, you know, applies... how do I word this? Universal is, say, for example, I'm teaching. Those children don't need any extra accommodations. You then have those who go under SEND support and they need, like, some extra provision in school. And then the children who can't be supported by that in school then need EHCPs. Okay, so they're the three levels currently in our graduated response. But what frustrates me yet again is some of these things that we're doing as, you know, the different for the SEND students would apply for all. So why are we not just going, do you know what? Let's just do SEND support for every child. I don't understand why we have the universal approach. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't get it. Because like I said, when I was using SEND approaches, and not just SEND approaches, mine was more about, you know, let's make it exciting and let's make it accessible for all. You know, if I have a child who hates writing, why set a writing activity? If I can assess them, I know obviously we need to learn how to write. That isn't, you know, the debate here, but obviously there's opportunities for that in other lessons and in other areas. But what you find in schools is the emphasis is placed on book work and evidence. And what I used to do is take photographs. And, you know, admittedly, I'd spend a lot of time annotating things that we did as a class, you know, which took more time for me as the teacher, I guess, even though people will say it was less because you're not having to mark their books. But it meant that those children who really hated writing, you know, and weren't engaged with that process, it meant they could be involved because instead of saying, right, to evidence this, I need it in your book, I'd say, right, let's do the work. I'll either take a video or I'll take a photograph and then I'll annotate what we've done and, you know, what you said and all that kind of thing. in your book. And then I could just stick a photograph of them in the book of what they'd achieved. And that child is, you know, engaged and access a lesson. And I don't understand why we can't get away with more of that in the classroom. I don't understand why everything has to be, right, okay, we've done this amazing lesson, because this is what used to happen. Okay, we've done this amazing lesson. Your learning has been amazing. I'm really, really proud of you. As teacher, it should be enough for me to now know where you are developmentally, so that I can plan, you know, the next steps for us. But no, sadly, for Ofsted and for the senior management, we have to put it in your book. So despite the fact that I already know you've achieved what I wanted you to achieve, no one will believe me until you go and write this down in your book. So then they have to go and write the thing down in their book. And, you know, the whole process for me is just, I get what it, why they're doing it. It's because we need data and we need evidence. But I think the emphasis has gone too far on that. And it's just too much pressure on teachers, it's and it's really boring for the kids.
It's weighted more in the act of trying to, well, ask cover, essentially.
That's what it feels like.
Because you're literally building these entire processes based on proving something happened rather than the actual act of the thing happening being the main focus, the actual learning.
Mm.
It's not. It's more about evidence that learning happened rather than the actual learning.
Teachers are not trusted. That is so clear.
Clearly.
We're not trusted. You know, and it's such a shame because, again, you know, I have met a few teachers who are probably not great. But the majority I've met, they're so creative and passionate. And that's why you go into that job. You know, I know a lot of people say, oh, if you can't do, teach. And I actually have met some people who that's also true for, you know, I don't mean that rudely. They've wanted to do other careers. They had a degree. They were like, oh, don't know what to do with this degree. I'll do a PGCE or something and I'll, you know, I'll go into teaching. But very often those ones don't last. Some do. But majority of people who go into it for the wrong reasons, they don't last when they realise what the reality of the classroom dynamic is and the workload. To be honest, the ones who are driven are the ones who really are in it, usually for the right reasons. Yeah, you do have career ones who just literally want to progress and go into senior management and have authority and good money and that kind of thing. But the majority of people that I've worked with, they're amazing. And, you know, again, this is why I'm always very cautious of just attacking schools. It's not really fair. We do attack schools quite a lot for like how much they've let our children down, but sometimes I think we do need to acknowledge it's not the teacher, it's the system, and the teacher is very often powerless. Do we have teachers who have also caused a lot of issues? Yes. I'm not taking away from that. Anybody who's had a bad experience with a teacher not understanding or saying, oh, they're fine in my class, as though somehow they're superior and they're, you know, better than you as a parent, and they like to belittle, and, you know, I've come across those too, so don't get me wrong, I appreciate they are out there. But the majority of us are there because we really want to help children and families, and we want, you know, we want to kind of make a difference. So, excuse me. But going back to the very original point of what the person said on the blog. So, you know, to say children should all be in school, well, wouldn't that be wonderful if that was the reality? It would be great because they are entitled to an education. But when you have children who aren't diagnosed or can't even be considered for specialist, and then the fact that specialist is often falling short, the answer is to apparently create more specialist provision, because a lot of independent schools at the moment are making profit based on the fact that there aren't enough places for children to go when they need specialist provision. You've then got the debate of, the majority of SEND students are in mainstream. Why are they not getting more support, and why are they not changing the system and the curriculum so that more children can be supported in that space?
It's a smarter move.
It would make more sense.
Because how many are undiagnosed, and you think, well, why do you need the diagnosis?
Yeah.
Because the system doesn't work.
Yeah, because we were told with our son that, oh, he's on the pathway, but as he's not diagnosed, we can't actually even consider him for specialist provision. So then we had to go private to get that diagnosis, which he now qualifies for specialist, and there's nowhere to place him because there's now that disconnect between his academic ability, which he's demonstrated at home, and I have evidence of, and his social emotional needs.
That's the other disconnect as well, because you like say, so can't thrive in mainstream school. You don't have the diagnosis, so you don't have access to specialist schools. But then you realise specialist schools don't actually apply to my child because, again, there's an academic aspect of it that they just won't meet because it's, again, developing their life skills or just basically being a glorified babysitter's club.
Mm.
And I think that's what insults me. Yeah. There's no in between. It's like you could either just not achieve anything academically in mainstream school or qualify to not learn anything in specialist school.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there are some that are a bit different, but generally in our area, yeah, this is kind of what you're up against.
A low expectation.
But the lady who posted on her comment on the blog said that she feels social services should be involved for anybody who's at home because she kind of assumed that, well, they're sat at home, they're sitting at home doing nothing all day. And I said, this is a dangerous assumption. And again, that's what triggered the blog. I'm not trying to attack this person. You know, again, I see this as, she's not the only person who has said it. Like, so many people have said this. And I see it everywhere online. So, you know, again, it's not about going on a witch hunt to this individual person. It is about the fact that this is a very mainstream view. So basically, you know, people think if you take your child out of school, they're doing nothing. I do know some families who say, look, my child's been at home for years and I'm not qualified to teach them. Or they might be a PDA and I physically can't get them to do anything. The local authority's like, oh, well, you took them out of school. Yeah, okay, it was for their mental health, but we don't care. That's enough for us to say, huh, leaving you to it, not our problem. Elective home education is what we view this as. So they're happy for that child to rot at home. No one cares. That child is invisible. Your family is invisible. And it, like, genuinely nobody cares. You have to fight to get anything else. So, for example, you can get an EO test package, education other than at school. And I think by default, any child who is taken out of the school system should be offered at least access to resources. There should be, you know, if even if they say, look, you know, you're at home, but we kind of, you know, we can't offer you specialist provision because your child's not diagnosed, which, again, this whole system still doesn't work in my mind.
It needs to be an in-between state.
But there should be something like, okay, but you can access support here and you can access resources here. Mm-hmm. Because what is important to us is whether we agree or disagree that you've taken your child out of school, whether we understand or don't understand that you've taken them out of school, the fact is they are at home and we would like to support to make sure that they are actually able to access some form of learning. Obviously, I'm a former teacher, so for our situation is a bit different. But I know so many parents who've taken their children out of school for very legitimate reasons. Well, they've been really forced to because they're just having such a bad time in school or they're having emotional issues and they can't transition to school. You know, that they're doing an amazing job as well. And I'm in awe of them sometimes because they don't even have the experience that I've had or, you know, the kind of knowledge of the curriculum and that kind of thing. And sometimes I look at the things they've done and think, wow, I wouldn't have thought to have done that. So when people say to me, oh, it's so lucky you're a teacher, I think actually that's got nothing to do with it. A lot of us as parents, I mean, actually, with our son, he's very complex. And although obviously some of the things I did at school helped, I've had to completely change my entire approach for him. So being a teacher, to be honest with you, is kind of null and void, I believe, in this situation. But people say it to me all the time, and I think they perceive it to be a compliment. I find it frustrating. I think it undermines how difficult this is, actually. But there you go. It's got, you know, it hasn't prepared me. Teaching didn't prepare me for what I live now daily, but that's another story.
Not at all.
But
you could argue at least you understand conceptually from an educational perspective the requirements of an education and how...
It's quite good to know academically where a child would normally be.
Yeah,
definitely.
So that's
because it's great to see that he's already surpassing some of his peers in those areas, you know.
It's quite satisfying, actually. Yeah. It kind of invalidates the whole schooling system, to be honest.
Yeah. I said to you, I wish that I was in a position to be able to help other people in our position, to be able to go and help tutor them. But the only option is Zoom, and I just don't feel that that's as effective. I need to be with the child.
I think that's a
it's so hard.
To grown up.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway... So the person said about, you know, social services should be involved. And again, the frustration for me is a lot of us have our children at home for really good reason. I didn't do any learning with my child for the first, you know, kind of part of him being at home because I just felt like he needed to chill and recover and just like be, really. You know, some people criticize that. Oh, you're not just doing learning with him every day. Well, no, at this point, he can't access anything. He is traumatized. Even when he was at school being traumatized, he would do nothing at home. Like, he wouldn't even read a book with me, nothing. He was so withdrawn and distant. And he lost any passion for anything. He used to just sit there and stare into space, didn't he? It was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, or just get very escalated. It was just, and you just thought, what's going on? And at the time, the school hadn't actually told us a lot of what was going on, and he didn't have the capacity to.
I think that's one of the biggest failures, actually. out of the blue, he's on a reduced timetable, and you're like, okay.
Yeah.
So it went from, don't worry about anything, you know, we'll take care of it, to, oh.
Yeah, within 2 weeks. Yeah.
And you're like, well, again, where's the communication? Especially when they know that he's obviously got issues with mainstream schooling. You know, you need that extra feedback to understand. You shouldn't suddenly, you know, be told out of the blue he needs to go on a reduced timetable. Well, where did that come from? You know, there was nothing preparing us for anything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know how well he's getting on. This was shielded from you. And I think that's also damaging, not just for us, because we don't know how well or how he's coping, but also from a psychological perspective of why our kid's mood suddenly changed. We have no insight as to why he's suddenly forlorn. You know, he's not going to communicate, and if the school doesn't communicate, you're having to play detective. Yeah. And I think that's another thing they never considered. Oh, if we have regular contact with you, or you had a bad week, or X, Y, or Z, you know, okay, what were the issues? If you could talk us through what the actual issues are, we could probably understand why he's feeling a certain way, or why he doesn't feel like talking to us anymore, or anything. You could see that, and we probably would have intervened a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Because you would have gone, to be honest, guys, we're going to call it as the parents and the people responsible for his existence. It's not working, is it? So we could have prevented a lot of the trauma if we were actually involved, but we weren't. We were shut out. Until it became too much of a problem that they couldn't cover up, that it became too much of an ask for him to appear full time, and they just wanted to offload him. And I think that's the biggest thing. If we had more dialogue, we could have prevented a lot of the trauma, and that is what I'm angry about.
I'm angry that I didn't want to send him to school in the first place, and I had so much pressure put on me to put him in. Because I was just fussing and all those things. And you think, I knew, I said to you, all he's known as love, nurture, patience and kindness. And he's accepted for who he is here. He's safe. And I said to you, I don't want him to go because I know that he's going to not experience that from other people. And that was a really hard thing. And I was pressured from every direction to go against what felt right to me. And I also knew, on a selfish level, I suppose, that if I didn't send him, I was going to get so much opposition. You know, people would just say to me all the time, you know, well, no, this is down to you. This is you being fussy. This is you being anxious. You're putting you're projecting your feelings onto him. And, you know, I would have had all of that nonsense. And how do you know? Because you didn't try. And, you know, and also because from the professional perspective, they just kept saying, if you don't get him in there, we can't get more eyes on him. Basically, your observations are not enough. We need a school setting to see it too, so that we can get the right support. And then, of course, there was no support.
There's no support. And I didn't see any diagnosis happening off the back of the failed school experience. Nothing. Still now, an appointment in September. I mean, that's bullshit.
Yeah, so like to put things into perspective, flagged up at 2, coming up 7, saw assault about, well, he saw assault last year, can't remember exactly when, but I think it was September. And they'd said, right, we're ready now to formalise everything. And then the appointment is a year after. So I just don't really understand.
It's an absolute joke.
I don't understand.
And they'll argue resourcing and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, we could go political about, you know, the fact that these areas are underfunded and X, Y, and Z. But again, a lot of it's the tools and processes, and your policies can be changed. That can actually change. Your 15-minute appointment year can change to something tangible, yeah, where you go, actually, we're going to save all this up and actually have maybe an hour session to then at least start scratching the surface. Because it's really funny when you actually put money down and you actually get a quality appointment in place because you had to go private. And then suddenly, over the series of a couple of days of interaction, you start seeing the child for what they really are and the struggles that they have. They come to the surface because you've actually spent time with the kids.
That's the key.
That's the thing. And it's so flawed. I mean, I could go off on the tangent on this, but
this is maybe another podcast.
But yeah, it's just, the whole thing is just crap. But the other thing, going back to the school as well, so you're taking him in, and I will say, you know, he's different, and And he was bullied. And I think that's the worst thing, is you're letting this innocent, sweet child who's, to be honest, too good for this world.
Yeah.
And doesn't deserve to endure any of this cruelty that this uncaring shit world will put on them. And I remember taking him in, and I remember distinctively there were some big windows in his classroom, and I just remember this kid pressed his face up against the window. The minute he saw him, his face lit up, and this sadistic grin on his face.
Horrible.
And I saw this child, and I thought, you're gonna be a fucking bully, aren't you? I've been bullied as a kid. Now the difference between me and my son is, yes, I had the trauma and the emotional experience, but I fought back, and I would always make sure that the bully got a good hiding, and people learned not to mess with me growing up. But that changed me as well as an individual, because I started not trusting other human beings. But at least I could fight for myself. My kid couldn't. And I just saw that look of that face. I thought, you're the bully, aren't you? You're the bully.
And it was, yeah. We later found out it was this child, and it was horrendous.
And
he'd also picked up on the fact that our son, again, we hadn't been told any of this. We found out our son was also being very easily led, and you know, he got blamed for stuff that he was told to do. He's
engineered to really to tough. Take the fall.
And then we as parents, when we did try and challenge it at one point, we're told, no, he did that. And you're like, yeah, he did. And of course he has to be told off. We are understanding he has to be told about that behaviour. But like, why is nobody addressing the fact that
he's
this
a
child
vulnerable
is
kid who's being
he's
manipulated.
Yeah.
He's being manipulated and bullied. And that's the thing I don't like, is I saw that kid and I even stared at him because I thought, you're going to be trouble. You are waiting for my kid. And I start thinking, I want to destroy your parents in front of you, because
oh my gosh.
Because this is what I turn into. Because I hate people, yeah. Especially bullies.
Yeah, me too. When I was teaching, I remember that was like one of my biggest things. As I used to say to the children at the beginning of the year, there's three things I won't tolerate. I can't actually remember all three of them now. But I think it was lying.
Stealing.
Can't remember the other one. That's so awful. I've gone blank. I've said it in another podcast. I'm sure it's somewhere else. But the biggest thing was bullying. Like, seriously, I said to them, you will feel my wrath if that happens. You know, I like to think of myself as a really patient, kind teacher. But if you bully people, if you become that person, then you will see a side of me that you don't like. Seriously, I strongly suggest that you don't do that. I said, I was bullied growing up. And it has stayed with me forever. As an adult, I am still impacted by that. And I said, and I won't tolerate it. And I didn't. And the parents loved it because I didn't have any of that stuff going on. Like, you know, even if things happened outside of the school, if things happened when it wasn't even in school time, I would deal with it in school time. And the kid's like, oh, we've got a lesson today. I'm like, I don't care about the lesson. This is being dealt with. Like, I do not like this behaviour. You know, some people might scoff and go, well, that's really got nothing to do with you. But like, seriously,
psychological safety.
Yeah, I used to feel like actually a lot of what I enjoyed about teaching was actually more that side of things, actually. Yeah, the academic stuff, obviously, I progressed all the children and I made it as fun and engaging as I possibly could at the time. What I feel like my real skill set was the connection with the children, the rapport and relationship that I built. And, you know, they really actually cared what I thought. And I cared about them, and they knew that. It wasn't just me trying to play authority. It was, I really cared about what happened to them. I cared about them as people. And I think that's something you can't teach a teacher to do, but it's what you need to be doing. Is you need to, you know, yes, your job is to teach, but there's so much more than that going on in a classroom, and especially the schools I worked in. And, you know, when people used to say, how do you do it? Because I'd always get like the tricky class. And by the end of the year, they were quite delicious, to be honest with you. You know, I just think all children are good. All children have got it.
They have the capacity for it. Yeah.
They have the capacity for like so much, and people underestimate them. And, you know, as an example with our son, so we're told, you know, he's naughty. And if we went out, we'd bump into children from school and they'd go, oh, he was naughty. He got put on his naughty table. He had to hear that. all the time.
That was basically his whole existence.
Yeah, it was. Being told seriously.
How bad and how unworthy he was.
Yeah. And then we'd be, you know, we might even be walking somewhere and see some children playing and they'd go, "Oh, why were you crying today?" And we're like, "Oh, were you crying today?" Yeah. But you can't remember why or how, or, you know, this is the problem. He's just not able to communicate. And so, again, can't very vulnerable. Feelings. It's so horrible. And, you know, when we realised that stuff was going on, we were having stuff fed back by the kids, by the parents. But eventually the school did start feeding back because we actually reported like this back to them and said, "Look, please keep us up to date. We want to know what's going on." And they said, "We were trying to protect you. We didn't want to stress you out. And we were thinking he needed to build a relationship with us and a trusting relationship with us. We can't keep running to you every 5 minutes. We, you know, that's what we were hoping to achieve." But that didn't happen. But, you know, you can kind of see why. So let's go back to the original comment that this person made. So cover the social services bit, children being entitled to an education. She didn't actually say entitled. She said, like, they should all be in school, basically, legally. No. And I said,
not legally.
Okay, but when you've got a child who's, a school can't meet their needs by their own admission, what are you supposed to do?
There you go, then. See, again, these are the musings of an uneducated person who thinks too one-dimensionally. And yeah,
but that's why this is an opportunity to educate those people of the reality, but they obviously don't go through this. You're
very diplomatic because, you know, my instinct is just to call them out for what they are, a simpleton. But, you know, that's just the way I operate. Again, you can go back to the whole "I can explain it to you, but I can't understand it for you" argument. I love that so much.
Yeah. Look, my concern is slightly that I think some people, I've really learned this on the blog, okay, and luckily the people who I'm referring to don't follow the blog. They just come on to have their say and then they go off. And they crack me up, those people, the trolls. But they crack me up because some of them come to be really nasty. And
baseless arguments, though.
Yeah, it is
that
often.
That can be defeated with logic. This is the funniest thing about it. You're like, you don't have the intellect to fight this level, because if you did have the intellect, you wouldn't be saying such stupid comments.
But I have learned to, like, seriously let it go. Some of the things you're like, I laugh at. Some of the things I do get angry at, and they might trigger me. But ultimately, what I've learned is you can't teach people who don't want to learn. They don't want to understand. They just want to live in their opinion.
You're using them as an example for others, aren't you?
Sometimes.
So you're using it as a teaching
method. I sometimes like to leave it, and it's hilarious because I find, like, a lot of people, like, sometimes I think, oh, I need to respond to this, but obviously I got so many people, sometimes I can't. And then other people do, and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. I really love the community we've got here because people do kind of deal with it. But some people aren't worth your effort because they aren't going to get it and they don't want to get it. And those people just, like, walk away. You always say, don't feed the trolls, and you're so correct. There's no point. And you know, yeah, I might be triggered sometimes, but I just let it go. You have to sometimes. And seriously, this is growth for me, right?
That is amazing because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you're like, oh, God, not another one. Okay, let me get the crayons out. Let me draw you a picture.
The thing is, what is difficult is you paint the picture that, oh, they're just really stupid. But yes, the thing is, this is where you and I are a bit different. I get frustrated by some of the ignorance, but that's what it is. It's ignorance. But sometimes that ignorance, it can't be helped. It might be from their own upbringing. It might be from their own education. You know, you don't know what circles they're in. But on the other hand, I just think, why do they feel the need to comment? It isn't a discourse. They're not doing it from a place where they want to understand. They just want to come and assert their opinion and have nothing back.
Yeah.
Or they just want an argument and a conflict, and there's no point. Don't waste your time on people who aren't really willing to hear it and to learn. You know, that's kind of my kind of take on it. Sometimes I do bite back, but generally speaking, I try not to because it's just not worth my energy. Like, I have RSD, rejection sensitive dysphoria, and so many times in the past I've got myself into some situations where I've reacted, and I'm now just trying to be a little bit more mindful about where I place my energy, because who's being affected? It's you. You're the person being affected. You know, I'm the person who is getting drained and looping and feeling low. They don't give a damn.
No, they don't. This is the thing. I mean, I'm not saying let them trigger a strong emotion. I jest when I do my little reactionary stuff. I couldn't care less. I just find them stupid.
You're very black and white, yeah, like that, aren't you?
I am very black and white, and I can't be bothered. And that's probably why I'm not on your page either, in terms of you know, contributing to it because...
Yeah, very rarely.
You'd probably be shut down. Because I'd just...
I don't think you would be. I think you should start your own page. Like, you know, very different approach to mine.
It'd be a complete...
But then I get called, you know, sitting on the fence. I just think it's really... But what it is with me...
You're trying to play diplomat.
I'm not even playing diplomat. The fact is, right, because I'm not playing anything. I'm really empathetic and I can see things from multiple perspectives. So for me, sometimes it might appear I'm sitting on the fence, but I can kind of see different points of view. And I can see, like, for example, the comment today, you know, I disagreed and I explained like why I disagree, but I can understand from her perspective. She's thinking, oh, these kids out of school just sitting at home doing nothing. And then I've corrected her that the majority are not, but there will be some that are. And also, let's not parent shame those parents. They shouldn't be in a position where they have to have their kid
at
home.
That's not their fault.
But then you've got, well, then put them in school, but it's not that simple. You also have their mental and emotional well-being to think about. And it's just so, it's not a black and white situation. It's not cut and dry. And hopefully she's been educated, but you know, there'll be a lot of people who have their opinions and they aren't going to change them. They will feel that somehow, you know, I actually wrote on there, look, social services aren't going to get involved in a child being at home. I mean, the local authority know they're at home and don't give a damn. They're like rubbing their hands together. Yes, one more child we don't have to pay for.
We saved money.
Yay. And now let's have a go at the parents for not working, even though they can't hold down a job while they have their child at home.
Yep.
But they can't send their child to a specialist school because they're not diagnosed or it's not appropriate. And they can't send them to mainstream because they're being traumatised there as well. So I just don't know what they want parents to do. You can't win. I think the breakdown in our society these days is we don't value a parent being able to afford to be at home.
Yep.
To, you know, and I'm not about to even educate, but just generally to be at home,
be
to
right.
kind of be the, you know, person at home running everything and making that a nice secure environment. This isn't a dig at parents who both want to go to work. That isn't the point. But I think in our society, the you know, you should have the choice. But society, the economy, there's no option for people to do this now. But then you get these situations where you, like, I can't work. What I do is I do a lot of voluntary work outside of the page, but I'm having to step down from that later in the year because I can't physically keep on top of that, plus home educating. It's too much. But I can't go into paid employment, so I'm trying to find creative ways to make money. That at the moment, I'm making none. And then people criticise you for not being employed, and you're like, this is just, what a crazy world we live in. But the priority is our child and his mental health. And... you know, that will always be the priority. But just going to finish with the social services thing. I don't think I've even fully addressed this comment, to be honest. But the social services thing, I used to teach children who were actually abused. And social services didn't have the resources to even help those children. So if social services can't even help children who are blatantly being abused and are sent home to the abusers, are they going to give a damn about a child being deregistered from school, really? I do know... from reading something online recently, that there were some parents who were cautioned, you know, the you have the right to remain, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That happened because their child was not going into school. And, you know, this is the other thing. Some schools push parents to take their child out because if a child is having issues going into school, instead of going, right, you know, we're taking this really seriously, the parent gets punished. They don't take on board why the child is having issues and... they just see it as a very cut and dry, they need to be in school. And the fact that there are so many more issues, I think what my point is there are more SEND children, there are more emotionally based school refusal cases going on. I don't even think refusal's the right name. When are we going to catch up and see that this is now a massive issue and it needs addressing and things need to change? Anyway, I'm going to go there because I'm losing my voice. So thanks for listening. And we will speak soon.